It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. The sesquicentennial of the Civil War continues this year. The first 3 days of this month mark the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. Although the story of the Civil War is often told from the perspective of battles, regiments, and victories and losses, millions of artifacts bring the history of this crucial American event alive today. One of the most expansive collections of such artifacts resides at the New York Historical Society, which recently challenged historian and author Howard Holzer to choose just a few that would tell the story of the war between the states. The result is his new book, The Civil War in 50 Objects, and Holzer explains to Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how he rose to the challenge.
Well, it wasn't easy, but the idea here is to tell a broad story through sometimes small, intimate, or grand pieces that people saved for posterity. The British Museum did this in the History of the World in 100 Objects, and so it's always a challenge. The Historical Society has 1 million objects, large and small, relating to the Civil War era. So they put out about 100 for me to choose from, and it was really tough. It was like Sophie's Choice times 10, picking the objects to represent the whole march from slavery to freedom, and trying to represent every kind of artistic and documentary medium that is represented in the collection.
Well, let's start with what you begin the book with, which is this artifact, these shackles that held a small child slave.
It's pretty brutal, and they're very small. They're pretty much life-size in this normal-sized volume. And it's probably maybe the most harrowing thing in the whole book. The idea that a tiny child would be kept at bay, and the reason, I think, that many of these, they were also called bilbos, the reason that children were shackled this way and then attached to other things is because on the journey to slavery from Africa, some mothers, desperate and fearful, would try in the middle of the night to throw their little ones overboard, really to sacrifice them so they wouldn't have to spend a life or the next generation spend their life in slavery. So it's so horrible, it's unspeakable, and these little shackles are the way that you can keep the mothers from sacrificing the children.
How did you balance bringing in aspects of slavery as the cause of the Civil War with some of the alternative explanations for the conflict that we hear tossed around a lot these days, states' rights and things like that?
Yeah. Well, I do have a bow to states' rights in that the mayor of New York was pretty much a secessionist himself. He wanted to maintain profitable trade with southern states. So he had the ultimate states' rights idea, which was to make a trade alliance with Louisiana, which was one of the first states to secede, and then to become an independent city-state. In other words, he wanted New York City to secede. Well, Abraham Lincoln made sure that didn't happen. So that's my one recognition that there were other factors at work, and some of them were commercial. But I'm of the view, and I think most historians are of the view, that there was only one cause of the Civil War. Certainly one. I mean, you can say secession caused the Civil War. The firing on Fort Sumter caused the Civil War, but nothing caused secession except slavery. And you can read that in all of the secession ordinances that were drafted by the states when they seceded and by the Confederate Constitution, which enshrined slavery as a virtue. I don't want to shrink from that as the cause of the war, and I don't think the book does.
Tell me about the challenge of trying to include objects that even in their own times had multiple interpretations and then bringing them up to date in terms of how we view them today. I'm thinking specifically of this painting of slave life in the South.
Oh, yes, the Eastman Johnson painting. And you're absolutely right. No one was ever sure what Eastman Johnson meant by this painting called Negro Life at the South. What is it supposed to show? It shows a rather contented group of people living in ramshackle circumstances and a mistress, a white mistress, emerging into the scene. The young black man plays a banjo. A couple is sort of spooning at the left of the scene, people looking out an upstairs window. I think it's supposed to show that life goes on for slaves, but Eastman Johnson so quickly became a sort of an abolitionist artist that I think you can easily interpret that he meant to say that the white woman at the right who is looking at this realizes she's looking at a vanishing world, a world that'll soon come collapsing down. But that's what makes art so interesting. You can read it so many different ways. The important thing, it's a really good painting also.
Indeed, you include several artistic representations. You include sculptures, political cartoons that were published, although you mentioned in certain cases they weren't published or distributed as widely during the war as they would perhaps after. Do we often give enough credit to the fact that there was an ongoing public dialogue that was being reflected in the arts at that time?
You know, that's a beautiful way of putting it. I've written about this for 40 years, and I will immediately steal your phrase and use it as my own. No, I'll give you credit. An ongoing public dialogue through art is absolutely true. It was not just editorials. It was not just the political. It was a battle of art. And the Confederates might have been equal players in that battle, but for the simple fact that they ran out of three things that were really important to wage that fight. One of them is artists, because there was universal conscription, and only 80-year-old or 10-year-old artists would have been safe. The second is paper. They had huge paper shortages, so much so that, as this book shows, some newspapers had to be printed on wallpaper. And third, they ran out of ink. They just didn't have the supplies to compete. So the dialogue really narrowed down to that between Democrats and Republicans in the North, pro-Lincoln and anti-Lincoln forces in the Union states. But meanwhile, there was a generation of soldier artists and pictorial weekly artists who witnessed extraordinary things that tell huge stories in very small and intimate ways. And I think there's one example in the book. It's a Frank Leslie's artist sketching a group of African Americans wandering into a Union camp. You almost can't even tell what it is. It just looks like a group of silhouettes, some on horseback, some walking, with soldiers looking on, some not even looking on. Well, why is it important? Because it's an example of enslaved people abandoning their plantation because, A, they knew the Emancipation Proclamation legally set them free if they could get away from their white masters, and, B, they had heard that Ulysses S. Grant's army was within a few miles. Now was their chance. They took their life in their hands. They fled. They walked into Union lines where they were embraced and recognized as free, no doubt put to work, but better than being enslaved. But the biggest story of all is who these slaves were. They were owned by Jefferson Davis,
wow,
the president of the Confederacy. And if this artist had not been on the scene to witness this huge ultimate rebuke of slavery, an institution that Jefferson Davis thought was divinely ordained, then we never would have had this record. So it's a tiny, almost unrecognizable sketch that tells a huge story.
Some of these objects have been written about so many times, you know, the copies of the Emancipation Proclamation, yet you managed to bring in not only a backstory to some of these documents, but you also find these other objects that could so easily be overlooked.
I tried. I was mesmerized by this sort of unattractive series of postcards. I guess they're postcard size, almost like index cards that had a series of buttons, brass buttons on them. And what they represent are soldiers, souvenir hunters, / scavengers who plucked buttons from the corpses of dead soldiers, or worse, went to Confederate or Union prison camps and traded liquor or extra food or tobacco for buttons. And they wanted to collect buttons. They had some intrinsic metallic value. And they were also like, they were like scalps. They were like trophies of war. So those are tiny, intimate items that tell sort of a scary backstory of the war. And then there were some things that were completely unknown to me. I've been writing about Lincoln for 40 years, and I never knew that Abraham Lincoln had, I knew of one example, but I never knew that the Historical Society had an earlier example of Lincoln going up to the War Department, where he went almost every night to get war news because the White House didn't have a telegraph. And there, taking a piece of War Department letterhead and jotting down electoral votes that he thought would lean to him or lean to his opponent in the 1864 presidential race, he was so nervous about finding a path to victory in that hotly disputed campaign that he almost did what Tim Russert did in 2000, putting together those charts with different electoral vote paths to the electoral majority. So here he was waiting for news of life and death from the battlefield, but also calculating his political life or death in the White House.
Which ultimately would have had an impact on the soldiers on the field.
And on emancipation, on everything.
Tell me about some of the objects you put together that kind of told the story of the soldiers from both sides and what their experiences were. In some of these objects, you really see that, particularly the letters, you see that the soldiers themselves are trying to make sense of the experiences that they're having.
Yeah, and you see things that you didn't expect. You see in Union soldiers' diaries, you know, racism, how they refer to the people of color that they encounter along the way. You see a desperation to keep life sort of normal. So Confederate prisoners do drawings of things like lice infestation and the infirmary, or they create their own newspaper written meticulously in almost calligraphic penmanship so that they could have something to read to pass around. They couldn't print it, so they made one copy and passed it around. You see a drum that a drummer boy used in battle with two bullet holes in it. And you see a flamboyant Zouave uniform, baggy red trousers, a fez, epaulettes, which were worn once upon a time by soldiers who were considered the toughest men in the army, almost like special forces. But they dressed in such a flamboyant way that they were huge targets. So, you know, amazing things, and amazing for their state of preservation as well.
What was perhaps one of the more surprising items that you came across as you went through the New York Historical Society's collection to compile this book?
The most surprising to me, without a doubt, was a copy of the Terms of Surrender between Lee and Grant at Appomattox. Ulysses S. Grant, when he went to Washington to assume the command of all the Union armies, went to a stationery store and was sort of entranced by this early carbon paper kind of a thing, thin, filmy, waxy paper that you could use to make copies. And when he was ready to ask Colonel Eli Parker to write down the surrender terms as he dictated them, he had Parker use this carbon paper and make four or five simultaneous copies. Then when he was done, he gave one to Lee, one to himself, one to somebody else to read, make changes, and then they did the final. When it was all over, Grant gave one copy to Colonel Eli Parker. Colonel Eli Parker was a Seminole Indian, and he stood out in this sea of very white faces. And when General Lee left the surrender room, he shook hands with all of Lee's staff, and when he came to Parker, he stopped sort of short, looking into this dark-skinned face. And then I guess he realized he wasn't black, that would have been too much for him, that he was a Native American. And he looked at him and said, "Well, at least there's one real American in this room." And Eli Parker looked right back at General Lee and said, "General Lee, today we're all Americans." So here is a memento of the final moments of the Civil War and a final confrontation where an American Indian had to be the one to say that unity meant racial unity as well.
Why use objects to tell the story of the Civil War instead of just using any one of the stories you present in this book to illustrate what the Civil War was about?
You know, there are so many ways into the story. I think this combines a kind of, darting in and out of different story approach. But it also is almost a tactile way of looking at the war. You can feel and touch objects. You can't really, but you can come so close with this wonderful color reproductions of these items that stand out so beautifully. And appreciate the artistic involvement, the preservation, the respect that people had over time, the commitment to keeping diaries, and the political determination to sign a 25-foot-long petition to end slavery in America, saving the flag that was waved from Broadway when the first New York regiments went off to war. There's a lot of emotion involved in objects, and I think the emotion comes through to the reader. It's not just about military strategy. It's not just about politics. It's about passion. And the passion is what I was hoping to recreate through this kind of visceral path to the history of the war.
Well, Harold Holzer, thank you so much for sharing the Civil War in 50 Objects with us.
Thank you for asking me.
Harold Holzer is the author of The Civil War in 50 Objects in partnership with the New York Historical Society, the oldest museum in New York City. He first spoke with Stephanie Lecce in May. Holzer has written and edited more than 40 books on Lincoln and the Civil War era and has won the National Humanities Medal. We'll take one last break, and then another in a series of Lake Effect Interns has an album launch. We'll get a preview of that CD, Twin Brother, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.